This is lesson number 11 in our Bible survey course, and the subject before us today is the creation of man in respect to when and why did God create man. Now, in the previous lesson, I basically dealt with the fact that God created man, or dealt with a creation being necessary both biblically and scientifically, as opposed to either atheistic evolution or theistic evolution. I tried to lay before you the biblical statement of direct creation to show you that the Bible says it didn't just happen, God did it. He created man, a man, not a bug or toad or a ball of jelly, but he created him a man with a mind and a soul and all of these things in the beginning. We've tried to show you that. I tried to show the illogical nature of the evolutionary theory and to show you how that it not only didn't make sense scientifically, but it didn't make sense logically at all. In this lesson, I'm going to attempt to complement the previous one by both a biblical and a scientific discussion as to how and when and why God created man. Now, to proceed to doing of this, I want to read a portion of the fifth chapter of the book of Genesis, and after I've read a little bit of it, I'll explain to you why I'm reading it. Genesis chapter 5 and verse 1 said, "This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day that God created Adam, in the likeness of God made he him, male and female created he them, and blessed them, and called their name Adam in the day when they were created." Now, I want you to notice here the book of the generations. In other words, he's saying this is an account of the generations of Adam, in other words, the life, and then the following lives of Adam. And he says, "And Adam lived 130 years, and he begat a son in his own likeness after his image, and called his name Seth." And I want you to notice that. This son was not a progressive thing that had moved into something else. It was in his own likeness, in his own image, called his name Seth. "And the days of Adam after he begotten Seth were 800 years, and he begat sons and daughters, and all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. And Seth lived 105 years and begat Enos, and Seth lived after he begat Enos 807 years and begat sons and daughters, and all the days of Seth were 912 years and he died. And Enos lived 90 years and begat Cainan. And Enos lived after he begat Cainan 815 years and begat sons and daughters, and all the days that Enos lived were 905 years, and he died," and so on. Now, a couple of things I want to point out to you. Someone says, "Well, you know, men don't live 900 years today, so that was a different time span." No, it wasn't. As you come down through your Bible, you'll find very clearly not an immediate drop of those years, but you'll find that these people slowly deteriorated in their lifespans. For instance, Noah, after the flood, lived to be 950 years old. He lived 350 years after the flood. But his son, who we have a record of, a chronological record of, and of his lifespan, only lived to be around 600 years old. That was Seth. And as we come on down, we find that in an equal number of generations, that it moved from a lifespan of 600 years down to about 175 to 80 years. Abraham lived to be 175 and Isaac to be 180. And so on down in the times of David. David said man's allotted days are 70, and that seemed to be pretty well settled off, even though Moses lived to be 120 and Joshua 110. So you'll find in your Bible a progressive decay of the lifespan of man and not a drop of lifespan, just an immediate drop during that period of time. The shortest age span we have recorded before the flood would be the age span of Lamech, and I'm talking about a man who died a natural death. As you remember, Enoch was raptured, or translated, in 365, but Enoch lived to be 777 years old. I'm sorry, Lamech, not Enoch. But Lamech lived to be 777 years old, and then after the flood, we move on down to 600 and so on down. So you do not have an immediate time drop in that area. Now, what you have here in the fifth chapter of the book of Genesis is a chronological order of each of these men. So-and-so begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so. You do not have a skip. You do not have a doubling. You do not have the case of brothers there, but you have an absolute time. This man lived so long and begat so-and-so, and he lived so long and begat so-and-so. And if you will total these out, work them down, you'll find that we have a record there, very meticulous and accurate and careful record, showing us that the flood came 1,656 years after God created Adam. It isn't a slipshod thing. It's very carefully set forth. And it is a record for the purpose of showing us something of how long man has been upon the earth. Now, it isn't difficult to follow that on down. You can come on down and find that we follow the ages of all of these men down to the birth of Abraham. And you'll find that Abraham was 100 years old when he begat Isaac, and Isaac was 60 years old when he begat Jacob. And Jacob then was, I believe, 137 years old, something like that, when he went into the land of Egypt. I'm not sure. But figuring that up, you'll find that it was exactly 215 years after Abraham was given the promise at age 75 when he departed out of Haran. 215 years after that, Jacob went into the land of Egypt, and it was 215 years after that that they came out of the land of Egypt, making a total of 430 years from the promise given to Abraham until the giving of the law on Mount Sinai, as Paul reveals to us in the book of Galatians. Now, these are accounts given in the Bible, and if we believe these accounts, and if we take the time that we can trace modern history back to, and really modern history back to the time of Israel's coming out of Egypt in about 1490, something like that, is a great deal more difficult to trace from there to here than it is to trace these times through the Bible. But if we take the most commonly accepted historical dating from that point forward, in which we do have written histories, we'll find that the Bible states or implies that man has been upon the earth for about 5,900 years. You get that? About that long at the present time. Now, the evolutionists claim a much, much longer time span. It's been the constant goal of evolutionists to prove the antiquity of man's existence, for in the process of doing so, they expect that they can prove the falsity of the Bible and the authenticity of some other reason for man's existence upon the earth. And they claim ranges all the way from 500,000 years to a million years, and I understand now that some are even claiming that man has been upon the earth in some sort of a human form for as much as 2 million years. I'm not talking about the length of time there's been life upon the earth, animals, but they're talking about man. When man actually got to the place that they could call him man, evolutionists say, well, it ranges all the way from 500,000 years to, or half a million years to a million years, and then there's some that say, no, even up as long as 2 million years ago, we know that man was upon the earth. And of course, the very tremendous amount of variation, about 400%, would indicate the lack of knowledge in that area. That's quite a variation, to say the least. Now, the first thing I want to ask is this, in the process of this study, is do we have real scientific evidence of this claimed antiquity of man upon the earth? In other words, they say, well, we have the fossil records. But, of course, there's all kinds of questions in the areas of the fossil records and the datings of those things. But when it comes to what we do know, that those things, not which somebody projects or speculates on, but those things which we know, those things which are present facts, without the Bible being considered, do we have evidence of this claimed antiquity? And I answer no. First of all, there is no historical record or certain scientific evidence to support it. Let's talk for a moment about a historical record. You can take man's existence upon the earth, and you can find that we have pretty good historic records for about the last 2,500 years. In other words, around 1,500 years B.C., we have some pretty good historic records there, though were not given for the purpose of giving us all the datings, but we have some relatively, dependable records going back that far, recorded history. Now, man today is saying then that man has been upon the earth for 500,000 to 2 million years, and in the last 2,500 years he has increased from the point of being smart enough to keep the records to all of the vast knowledge that man has accumulated today, and that's been done in 2,500 years, but in 2 million years, he just barely learned to write. Now, really, that becomes a little bit inconceivable, and we'd say, boy, the increase of knowledge is just really quite unbelievable in that respect. If we were just to take the increase of knowledge and compute it back, I think we would say, well, you know, with this sort of an increase of knowledge that we're seeing today, we would have to conclude, if we have any sort of continuity in that, and we put it on a sliding basis to go back, you know, and multiply percentage-wise backwards, that man surely has not been upon the earth that long. It just wouldn't make any sense at all. Not only is there no historic record of it, but we find that by scientists' own indication of their lack of knowledge, that they themselves know they don't know. Now, let me give you an illustration that took place here in Lubbin in the early 1960s, perhaps in the year 1960. I believe probably it was in 1960. But out east of our town, they were digging gravel, loading them on dump trucks and hauling them off for various things. And in the process of digging up the gravel, they unearthed an elephant tusk. So immediately they sent to the University of Oklahoma and had some real high-rolling metal giants to come down and take a look at the elephant's tusk. And they began to dig around with their fingers and their teaspoons and all of these kind of things. And it was not very long before they, quote, found the jawbone of an elephant. Not only that, but along with this, they found a spearhead. And so, my goodness, here is an elephant tusk, and they test this elephant tusk out, and this elephant tusk was over 8,000 years old, and here's the spearhead alongside of it, assuming that the spearhead is what killed the elephant. And so they wrote a big article in the Lawton Constitution. I wish I'd have kept copies of it, but the headlines went like this. At last, we have proof that man has been upon the earth for more than 6,000 years. Now, the very statement that at last we have proof is an admission that they know they did not have proof before that. So they took the elephant tusk, and may I say they covered the front page with all of this great information that they now have. And just, boy, the evolutionists now have it together. And the Bible has proven untrue in all of those things. And I told my wife, I said, now watch for this, because you're going to find before too long that there'll be a retraction of this, and they'll hide it just as carefully as they can. So in about 2 weeks, there was a little article. I don't mean a half a page or a quarter of a page to counteract the full page. I mean a little article about the size of two of your fingers way over on the back page of the paper that you had to watch for or you never would have found it. And this informed us that the elephant tusk, upon further examination, was only 4,000 years old, and that what they thought was a jawbone was not a jawbone, and that it was only a formation in the chat, and what they thought was a spearhead was not a spearhead at all, but it was only a formation in the chat. All they had was a 4,000-year-old elephant tusk. And, of course, when they had at first said 8,000 and then 4,000, now how old was the elephant tusk? And we have no way of knowing that it wasn't 4,000, 2,000, or 27 years old. It wouldn't surprise me that someday they'll go down in the area where we played as boys and dig up some of the garbage we buried and assume that we have ancient mankind that buried that stuff many, many generations ago because of some of the crazy places we put it. So what I'm saying is that this very statement that they made here indicates that they themselves know they do not know. Now, I want to say something else, that the world population indicates a very short history. If you take the population of the world today and then take the evolutionist time scheme, even the 500,000-year time scheme that they claim, do you realize that the Earth's population would only have been allowed to double every 17,000 years? That's right, every 17,000 years. Now, we look at our population here today, and we see a much greater doubling rate. If we look back to the history where we've kept statistics and we know what the population of man is upon the earth, we realize that it's been doubling something like every 150 years. And even perhaps that may be greatly increasing, in fact, is greatly increasing at the present time. Now, what I'm saying is this, that the evolutionist time estimate there would allow it to double every 17,000 years, whereas if we take the creationist opinion of the time, I'll show you in a moment what it would come out to be. But if we say 150 years, it's very much more consistent with the population of the earth that we have today. Now, let me show you something. I took my calculator here, did something just a few minutes ago that I think would add some light to this. If I take my Bible history, and then I use the best historians that I'm able to get from the time that the Bible quit computing time, about the time of the children of Israel coming out of the land of Egypt, we come on down from that point forward with the chronologies of the Hebrew kings, and then the times of recorded history that we have today, we come out to indicate that man has been upon the earth a total of a little bit less than 5,900 years. Just a little less than 5,900 years. Now, it's 1,656 years after the creation of Adam that the flood came and destroyed all but eight souls according to the Bible. That would have been, according to the using the 5,900 year time, 4,244 years ago, approximately, it was a little less than that, that Noah came out of the ark. Eight people came out of the ark. Let's take those eight people then and begin to double them. And if we double that 28 times, would you believe that we come out with a population, a world population of 2,147,483,648 souls. Now, that would be doubled 28 times. If you take that 28 and divide it into the 4,244 years, then we come out with a gain over that period of time of 151.5714 years per doubling. And it's so very close to the actual records that the earth has today. You see what I'm saying to you, that mathematically and scientifically, that what the Bible says, as strange as some think it is to indicate such a short existence of man upon the earth, it is so much more consistent than what you find in the opinions or the projections of the evolutionists. And so the time span or the population of the earth is a very good indication that man has been upon the earth only a short period of time. The world population indicates it. And you ask yourself, is it easier for me to believe with the scientific evidence and the historical evidence that we have today, including all the death rates of man, you know, how fast they've died off and all of those things, that we have a consistent redoubling of the earth's population every 150 years or every 17,000 years? Now, it's quite a span there. It indicates a pretty clear conclusion. Let me go a step farther and point out to you that the fossil records do not disprove the biblical account. Now, many, many scientists today will try to claim that you just cannot reconcile the biblical account with the fossil records. And yet many competent scientists say that they very definitely establish it. There's a book written concerning the Earth's age and a statement, "The Fossil Records Say No," by a man, a scientist by the name of Dwayne Gish. And may I recommend to any of you men who are interested in the study of this any further, if you're interested in really learning some things about the scientific opinion of creationism, get the books by Henry Morris and Dwayne Gish in these areas. They're very good. And, you know, they've gone all over this country debating with evolutionists, and it's come to the point that an evolutionist will hardly touch them. The evolutionists are afraid to debate them because they wind up looking like jackasses every time they do, which of course is very logical because that's what they are as far as any kind of logical reason is concerned. And they've just about quit debating these men. They have some very good books out that will show you that when we talk about creation, that we're not talking about something that's unscientific as opposed to evolutionists being a scientific thing. Now, let me say something else, that all scientists know that carbon dating is very, very uncertain. Now, they will often say, well, you know, certainly they are uncertain, but, you know, they all with one accord indicate such an old earth that creation cannot possibly be right. In other words, one man dates something and he says it's 500,000 years old. Another man dates it and he says it's 1 billion years old. And they say, well, you know, that of course is a great difference. We admit that. We acknowledge that. But after all, the agreement is so great that it still makes a 6,000-year-old earth an impossibility. Well, I ask you, does it? When we say one man says 2 billion and another says 500,000, and one says 500,000 even and another says 2 million. And we take this and say, well, now, wait a minute. When we begin to arrange for the area of mistake, if this man who has made the 2 billion a year thing is that mistaken as compared to the one who's made the 500-year million, what's another 450 million years, another 450 million years or something like that, or you see, your differentiation there simply is not enough to say that they are at all in agreement. They are not in agreement, and you can easily enough bring the 6,000-year existence into their mathematical projections as easily as you can the variation that they show. Now, the fact of the matter is that scientifically, most fossil placement in the earth is much more easily accounted for by the flood than by slow erosion. In other words, if you try to take the idea or the projection that we just have an erosion upon the earth, and because of just erosion over many, many periods of years, we have down here these huge coal fields, we have these large areas of oil deposit, and all of these things that took place because of millions of years of slow change and slow evolution, you really run into some very serious mistakes. But if you take a flood, a great catastrophic move upon the earth, where the destruction of these various kinds of animals and plant life and stuff of that sort, it then becomes very easy to account for the deposits of oil and gas and coal and things like that under the earth. Even the petrified forests and things like that that seem so very strange can be far more easily accounted for by a catastrophe of the flood than they can by slow erosion and slow world change in the earth today. It just really works that way. There is a book by a man by the name of Kelly Seagraves, a small book called The Great Dinosaur Mistake. And in this book, he shows how that they assume, because we don't find any huge dinosaurs that are compatible with the fossils that we find on the earth today, that the dinosaurs are extinct and have been extinct for all of these many, many years. And he concludes, and I think very logically, that we might well come to the realization that the dinosaurs are not indeed extinct at all, but simply that the size of the dinosaurs was drastically changed at the time of the flood because of the change of ages of men. Now, if you take the lifespan of man before the flood, you'll find that it is approximately 13 and a half times the lifespan of the average man today. What many people do not realize about a reptile is he's not like a man, in that a man grows for a certain length of time to maturity, and then he ceases to grow. I'm no taller now than I was when I was 17 years old. In fact, I am a little shorter at this point, probably because of the settling of my bones and the drooping of the body and the falling of the chest and things of that sort. I'm a little bit shorter than I was when I was 17 years old. I've grown a little bit in width, but I would wear the same size gloves and the same size shoes and things of that sort that I wore when I was 17 years old. Now, man grows like that and then he stops. Not so with a reptile. Reptiles continue to grow as long as they live. So if you take a reptile and you allow him to continue to grow percentage-wise for 13 and a half times his lifespan now do you see how much larger he would be? For instance, if he doubles in size the first year, doubles in size the second year, doubles in size the third year, doubles in size the fourth year, and dies. Let's say he dies that way. Let's say that he dies a 13-year-old rattlesnake, doubling in size every 2 years. Let's just imagine that he does that. I'm not sure just how that works. Let's say that he does that. Then you take that rattlesnake, and he lives 13 years and dies an 8 or 9 foot rattlesnake and has doubled in size every 3 years. You let him live 13 and a half times that long and continue doubling in size at the same rate, and listen, you're going to have some kind of a monster of a snake. Now, the same thing is true with all reptiles, lizards, and everything like that. And actually, the word dinosaur itself really means terrible lizard. We have some lizards in South America that are 12 feet long. Let that lizard live 13 and a half times as long as he does now and see how big he gets. Mr. Seagrave shows us in his book how that there is really no reason to claim that the lizard or the dinosaur is extinct at all, but simply he's not as large as he was then. Someone says, how could Noah have gotten a dinosaur on the ark? All he had to do is put a smaller one on there. No problem, as long as it's just not as big as some of the fossils that we have today. And so men have taken these things and, doubting the Bible account to begin with, have made all sorts of projections that lead us to false conclusions. And so the time span of humanity upon the earth and the things that we have involved with this simply does not indicate 500,000 years or 1 million years or 2 million years, but all sorts of logic much more clearly indicates about the 5,900-year span that we have, with a catastrophic flood destroying mankind only about 4,250 or 4,144 years ago, a little less than that, in fact, because we don't really have quite the 5,900-year existence according to the Bible. So I think that the Bible account of the time of Earth's existence here is a very logical one. Now, you may begin to say, well, how about all of the diamonds and stuff like that in the Earth? How in the world could they have been created in such a short time? Well, God created a diamond in 2 seconds if he wants to. You see, the evolutionist has started out with the idea that it takes so much time for these various rock formations and stuff to be created by the process of evolution. And then somebody comes along who has to be a half-wit to try to interpret the Bible by that and say, well, how long did it take God? You know, after all, we have to give room for the time span that the evolutionist is claiming. No, we don't have to give room for that at all. If God created it, then we don't need a time span of any sort. I mean, if God created it day before yesterday and we weren't around to see how it was done, then all we have is the revelation that God has given as to how he created it. Now, thirdly, I want us to consider this question. Does the Bible, we've looked at two things, the time span of humanity on the earth, and then the question, do we have real scientific evidence of this antiquity that is claimed by the evolutionist? Thirdly, I want to state this, that the Bible does indeed address itself to the time factor. Now, some theistic evolutionists, let me recap that term so you know for sure what I mean. A theistic evolutionist is a person who tries to straddle the fence and claims that he believes in God, but he believes that God created by the process of evolution. And the first time I ever met one of those fellows, I believe it was back in about 1962, I thought I'd flip my lid to even be hearing somebody that sounded so silly state what he believed. But the theistic evolutionist is a man who claims that he believes in God, but that he believes God created these things through the process of evolution. May I pause for a moment and regress just a little bit to say, you keep hearing today of the Big Bang Theory. I heard a scientist debating Henry Morris and Dwayne Gish some years ago say that what he believed in was the chitty chitty bang bang theory. In other words, that everything moved along real slow for a while and then it banged, and then slow for a while and then it banged. And now the necessity for their bang theory is the evidences they see of catastrophe. In other words, areas that they say, well, this had to take place by a rapid catastrophic change on the earth. This could not have taken place by a slow erosion process. And the evolutionist himself knows that. And so he says, well, we have all this slow time, and then we have a big bang. And the creationist says, yeah, we did have a big bang. The thunder roared, and the lightning flashed, and the fountains of the deep were broken up, and God flooded the world, and that's where all of these fossil records come from. Now, I believe that that's much more consistent. But then let's go back to the third question that we were going to ask ourselves, or the third statement made in this outline, and that is that the Bible does address itself to the time factor. Some evolutionists try to say, well, you people are trying to make more out of the Bible than it makes out of itself by supposing that it addresses itself to a time factor when it really doesn't. In other words, they say that the fifth chapter of Genesis that says that Adam lived so many years, and that's not really intended to be taken that literally. We're not supposed to look at that like that. We shouldn't take the book of Genesis literally. Well, I say if we shouldn't take the book of Genesis literally, throw the whole thing out and go home. But to say that the book of Genesis is not intended to give us an account of the time factor is about as accurate and about as sensible and about as logical as to say that your calendar is not supposed to give you any kind of the indication of the arrival of the days of the year, or that the various things we know concerning the sun are not supposed to teach us anything about the seasons. The accurate account there is Adam lived to be 130, and he begat, and you look at these men, and you find they are not in round figures. One man, for instance, we find that Adam lived to be 130. We find that Seth lived to be, Adam lived to be 930. Seth lived to be 912. Cain lived to be 910. Enos lived to be 905. Noah lived to be 950. Jared lived to be 963. Methuselah lived to be 969. And on down the line, and you notice it's not an approximate numbering there, but they are uneven numbers and even numbers and factors that show us that the Bible is intending to give us an absolute age span of those men. And we have that age chronology all the way to Mount Sinai. Now, I want to review that for you just a little bit. You can follow through the fifth chapter of the book of Genesis, and you can find the age time all the way to the flood. And then you can go on in the book of Genesis over to the, it is the 11th chapter of the book of Genesis, and beginning with verse 10, and you'll find a continuation of that, verse 10, and these are the generations of Shem. Shem was 110 years old and begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. Now, don't you think that anybody that believes the Bible at all and has as much sense as a turnip has to come to the realization that this is intended to tell us how long the time span was. You go on to verse 26 of the 11th chapter of Genesis, and Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And you go on to the beginning of the 12th chapter, and we find there, now the Lord said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house and the land that I will show thee, and I will make thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing, and I will bless them that bless thee and curse them that curseth thee, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So Abraham departed as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him, and Abraham was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And this is the time of the promise that we have the chronology dated from. And then Paul says the law came 430 years after the promise to Abraham. And you have such absolute detail in the datings all the way on up to the time that the nation of Israel went into the land of captivity, into the land of Egypt, and you can just dot it right on down the line. Now, to say that the Bible does not intend to give us that time chronology is in essence to say that the Bible doesn't mean anything at all. We have the chronology all the way to Mount Sinai, and from that point forward it is not very much trouble to trace it on down even through modern history. Now I realize we have the differences of the reign periods of the Hebrew kings, and that's because we had a difference of dating methods in the nation of Judah as opposed to the nation of Israel. Not only that, but they changed their dating methods. The nation of Judah changed their dating methods twice. The nation of Israel changed their dating methods once. And so you'll have some difficulty in the process of getting all of the current reigns or the concurrent reigns of the Hebrew kings to come out exactly the same. But as you study it, it will come out right if you'll actually take time to study it. But the point is that the Bible does give us a time span and indicates about a 5,900-year time span of man upon the earth. And I believe indeed a 5,900-year existence of the earth. That sounds too fundamental or too narrow to you, then that's your problem, not mine. I have no problem with it at all. It doesn't bother me one bit. Doesn't make me one bit nervous to take odds with a scientist who says that the earth has been here for billions of years, and for me to say, no, it's been here for a little less than 6,000 years. Now then, we come to a final question that we want to address in this lesson. And the question is this: why did God create man? Now, it's been stated that God created man because he was lonely in order to fellowship with him. I've heard man say God heard men say God created man for the purpose of fellowship. And I've heard others even go so far as to say that God created man because he was lonely and he wanted somebody to fellowship with. This, of course, may I stop for just a moment there to say, it's glorious that God has given us the privilege to fellowship with him. I don't want to take away from that. That's wonderful. I'm very glad for that. But, beloved, please don't fall into the trap of saying that God created man because he was lonely and needed the fellowship of man. This is very foolish. This foolish theory attacks all sorts of the basic attributes of God. First of all, it attacks the perfection and the independency of God. In other words, if God was perfect, to say that he was lonely and then that he improved his state by the creation of man takes away from the transcendency of God. It takes away from the whole concept of the perfection of God and of the independency of God. It attacks a basic principle to say that God was lonely and he created man, and after having created man, he either ridded himself of that loneliness or will one day rid himself of that loneliness. Either of the two is totally foolish. Not only that, it attacks the immutability of God. The Bible very clearly defines and describes God as being immutable, and yet the idea that God was once lonely and is not now lonely, or was once lonely and will not be lonely in the future, is very contrary to the idea of the immutability of God. Let's not give ourselves such answers as that. The Bible doesn't say that, even though it does teach us that God fellowshiped with man. He walked with Adam and talked with him in the cool of the day. And he fellowshiped with man, and he fellowships with me, and I fellowship with him. And I'm glad for that. But to say that that's the reason God created man, in the sense of indicating that God had a need of that fellowship, or was incomplete, or was dependent without it, is absolutely foolish and is very akin to profanity, if not blasphemy. It attacks also the wisdom of God, in that we see that man's fellowship with God today is indeed very limited. In other words, if God created man as a creature, as a whole, for the basic purpose of fellowship, then is it not very strange that so many men today are refusing to fellowship with God, and such a tiny, tiny number of them do have any sort of fellowship with God? This, of course, attacks the wisdom of God. Not only that, it attacks the doctrine of the omnipresence of God, since it states that there is a subsequent purpose on the part of God. That is to say that God had in his own existence a purpose that came about because of a state that he experienced. In other words, God experienced a state of loneliness and subsequently decided to create man. God never subsequently decided to do anything. If God is omnipresent, That means that all of God's decrees are eternal. Everything that God ever has done or ever shall do, He always intended to do. And His purposing in that was absolutely independent of those things which have subsequently come to pass. Never imagine subsequent purpose on the part of God. We have subsequent purpose. In other words, we decide to do something, it works to a certain extent or not at all, and we subsequently decide to do something else. But as far as God's intentions are concerned, they are never subsequent. They are always eternal and totally independent of results. Now then, secondly, let's consider that God created man, or that the reason belongs only to revelation. We'd have to have revelation. Deuteronomy 29:29 tells us that secret things belong to the Lord, revealed things belong to the sons of men. And therefore, if we are to know at all why God created man, then, beloved, we better find out from the Word of God. And the book of Revelation, chapter number 4, and verse 11, very clearly tells us why God created man. He created him for His own pleasure. Now, that may include fellowship, no question about that. But if you'll go ahead and read the following verses in the 11th chapter, the fifth chapter of the book of Revelation, you're going to find that the pleasure that God found there was in redemption. And it seems that redemption is essentially the purpose for which God created man, was for the glory of His Son. Now let me say this, if we include creation in predestination, when I say predestination, I mean by that the things that God has before determined and destined to come to pass. And if we do that, and I think we must, if we consider all things that are sequential to our eternity with Christ, in other words, we say, well, our eternity with Christ is based upon this, which is based upon this, which is based upon this, which is based upon this, and all of that was predestinated before the foundation of the world, according to Romans chapter number 8 and verse 29, whom He did foreknow, that He did also predestinate to be conformed to the image of His Son. If that conformity to the image of His Son includes the predestination of man as much as it does the keeping of man, the calling of man, the choosing of man, and all of those things, if all of that is included in it, then we have to say that the entire thing was looking forward to the time when Christ would be made the firstborn of many brethren. And if we do this, we're going to find harmony in the Genesis record. If we don't, we will not. We'll say no more concerning the purpose until we get to later lessons. Thank you.